This is the 53rd edition of WFAE Talks. I'm News Director Greg Collard. Lisa Worf is our education reporter. Hello, Lisa.
Hey.
And Ben Bradford covers the environment and city government.
Yes, that's sometimes.
Well,
thanks.
Well, first, let's talk about state government. Governor McCrory quickly vetoes two bills this week, what's known as the Ag Gag Bill, which would allow business owners to sue employees who secretly record at the workplace. And he vetoes legislation that would let magistrates opt out of performing same-sex marriages. Quick action by the governor. I guess some definite policy differences he has with lawmakers on these issues, obviously.
Yeah, well, he said, you know, back in March on Charlotte Talks that he had problems with the magistrate bill, and you know, but it wasn't clear, and I think I would say they were holding their fire on what he would actually do with it until it actually passed. So I spent a lot of time yesterday asking the governor's office, hey, what is he going to do on this? Is he going to veto it? Mm-hmm. Yes or no? Can you get me an answer by, you know, 4 p.m. and not hearing back from them, and then at 3:57, this press release comes across the wire saying McCrory says he will veto it, because it wasn't clear. You know, it could be he has a couple of options there. He doesn't necessarily need to veto it. He could just not touch it, say, you know, and then leave it alone, ignore it, and it becomes law anyway. So he doesn't necessarily need to sign it into law or veto it. That's another way of saying, well, I don't agree with it, but I'm going to let it happen. We've seen him use that tactic in the past.
Will these vetoes be overridden? I guess that's the main question. It's close.
Yeah, I was crunching the numbers yesterday. It's right on the line. The Senate has the votes, provided everybody votes the same way they did before. The Senate has you need 3/5 of the people voting to override a veto. Republicans have those numbers in both chambers, but in the Senate, they have a couple votes more than they need to override the veto. The House was at 67 yesterday when they passed the magistrate bill. And there were 10 members that did not vote. The votes you need for 110 people that did vote, you would need 66.
Okay.
So it's really just if that other 10 shows up and which way they vote, if they do. And there might be other members who decide, you know what, no, I voted for it, but now that it's been vetoed, I don't want to vote to override the veto. So you could have some swings that way. But either way, it's close is the bottom line.
No strong statements really coming out of Senate or House leaders on this yet.
They haven't published anything, at least.
Yeah, nothing that indicates that they would necessarily have a try for an override vote, right? They haven't said they would.
The magistrate bill is the pet bill of Senate Leader Phil Berger. He introduced it, which is an unusual thing for a leader in either chamber to actually spearhead. I mean, a lot of times they don't even vote. I would be surprised if he didn't champion it more because it is his bill. But it may be that they feel that they don't have enough votes to override the veto as well. So, it's sort of a wait and see. At the same time, you know, the action that you'll see often, you know, very rarely do things actually get put up to a vote if they don't have the votes to pass.
City government now. It's going to be a contentious meeting Monday with the city council. Is that expected where they're going to be voting on a local civil rights ordinance?
It's certainly a touchy issue. So this is something that they've been looking at since last year, and it stems directly from both the shooting of Jonathan Farrell by CMPD, and then also, you know, kind of nationally, the other sort of similar we've seen, you know, black men shot by police officers or killed by police officers in Ferguson and, you know, North Charleston, New York, those kinds of things. And so the city began looking at, do we need to set out an anti-profiling policy? And it also, you know, it stems from this larger issue. And also, like in New York, for instance, like stop and frisks, we have the same thing in Charlotte, those kinds of things. And so the council began looking at it. The one of our state representatives, Rodney Moore, not to be confused with police chief Rodney Monroe, but Rodney Moore was pushing for Charlotte to adopt an ordinance that specifically spells out that police will not conduct racial profiling and handling of other sort of, you know, things like stop and frisks and things along those lines. And so this was something that the CMPD has resisted, and it's been kind of interesting watching it play out because, you know, Rodney Monroe, the police chief, after being asked this, he gave a presentation to the city council where they were supposedly discussing doing this. But instead, what happened is it turned into this presentation by Roddy Monroe about how they were already doing it, how CMPD already does these things, and kind of asking the council to, you know, hold off and, you know, and give kind of a light set of principles, mm-hmm. but understand that CMPD feels is already doing these things. So obviously that's contentious.
Right.
There's a lot of people in Charlotte who feel that that's not the case. They feel that they're being targeted, and I know that the city attorney wants.
He wants it as a resolution and not an
right.
ordinance.
And the difference is between law and sort of the sense of the council. So a resolution would be, this is our policy, but it's basically the difference between a rule and a guideline.
Mm-hmm.
And so one has a lot more power than the other. And I don't know how it's going to go, but I would imagine that some on the council will feel each way.
Mm-hmm.
And either way, there's going to be some people who are unhappy.
And also, you've been speaking as other city matters, the budget, you finished,
yep.
Is that's all wrapped up, it looks like?
Oh, it's not all wrapped up.
Oh, it's not all wrapped up? Okay.
No, it's
a little details, but the big deal is finished.
I think we're starting to see the main picture of it. Things could change. Actually, on Monday, before this racial profiling ordinance resolution, whatever they end up doing, and they're not going to make a decision on that, by the way, on Monday night, but they're going to get sort of this another presentation and then discuss what it is they want to do. But there might be some other changes that you can see council members proposing, things to add and things to delete. But yeah, we have the main shape of it. And again, that's a 1 cent increase to the property tax, changes to the trash fee. It's been a lot of issues. I never thought I'd learn so much about the way that our trash works in Charlotte. But it's become entirely wrapped up with how Charlotte does its budget, because they're facing this big budget hole. There's it's predominantly from the loss of business income, or at least that's true. Essentially, the city manager found a way to using trash fees and removing some trash fees that homeowners pay, found a way to try to shift more taxes onto businesses which are paying less. Now, that's sort of the general philosophy, and it won't be true in any given case.
Mm-hmm.
So that framework is now pretty well set out. The council kind of decided to do a more limited version than what the city manager had proposed, and they've added in this fee. One of the things that they're doing now is they're balancing it. They'll balance the budget by adding a fee for small businesses that receive city trash, and this is kind of an interesting thing because small businesses have not paid the fee for trash.
Yeah, I kept asking you. I was very confused in editing. What
right.
in this this story? I had no idea.
So businesses don't get pick up from the city. They have to pay for their own trash services. Mm-hmm. Except that small businesses can opt into having the same garbage can that you or I have. That homeowners have. It's a 96-gallon trash mm-hmm. can, which is kind of your standard trash can, and they can use that. And if they do that and they opt into that, then the city will pick it up. And it costs more because they're on their own schedule, and that means that trucks have to go to small businesses, which are much less of them than homeowners, so you don't get the same economy of scale. Mm-hmm. So it costs more. But what they've done, and this is kind of interesting, is they've added a $250 fee, which is what they say is the total cost of servicing these 2,100 businesses. So basically over 2,000 businesses would pay an extra $250 every year to get their trash picked up. The thing is that right now, if you're a homeowner you pay a $47 fee. That doesn't cover the entire cost of your trash. That is part of the cost of your trash. The entire cost is over $100. The rest of it comes out of general fund, property taxes, kind of fund the other part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So by both increasing property taxes and requiring small businesses to pay the entire cost of their trash, it's actually going up what small businesses pay much more than what homeowners are paying or what apartments or condos have to pay. So because their trash fee is subsidized by property taxes, and now small businesses are going to both have to pay an increased property tax, and their trash is not subsidized. So it's an interesting way of doing it. Wasn't able to ask the city council members at the meeting where they decided to do this what they thought, because they immediately went into closed session. And then we had to get on the air to tell people this is what was happening, because I know it's super exciting. But it's certainly something that we'll follow up on Monday.
How much do these businesses have to pay for the business franchise tax that was wiped out?
Yeah, that tax was so convoluted that it depended on the business. It depended on several different factors. It was apparently one of the most convoluted taxes, and everybody kind of agrees on that. The total amount of revenue across that tax that the city was collecting, and that includes from some businesses outside of the city of Charlotte, because they could collect it from other places that were doing business with Charlotte and so forth, was $18 million.
Okay.
The entire sort of trash swap, raising the property taxes, all those different kinds of things there, ends up being about $7 million. So they're not recouping all of the business income that they lost. They're doing cuts and, you know, fee swaps and some, you know, and other things. But it's more of like a third of it.
All right. Well, on Station Matters, we started a new series this week, Block by Block. It was kind of a team effort in coming up with this idea where basically we've had a lot of stories lately about changes to maybe a business going out that's been around forever or some, and someone else was working on, Gwendolyn Glenn was working on a story about gentrification in the Cherry neighborhood. And we just decided to, hey, there's a lot of stories we can be doing over the next several months about changes going on in the Charlotte area as more apartments are built and the price of property that wasn't much a few years ago is now suddenly skyrocketing, like Plaza Midwood and Noda areas, and fabric of the neighborhoods are changing. So we're just going to put these stories together under a banner called Block by Block, and some of these stories will be about big changes, some will be small changes. One example about a big change, Gwendolyn kicked it off with a story on gentrification going on in the working class African-American community of Cherry. And Marshall had a story on John's Country Kitchen in Plaza Midwood. You've been a customer there before, right? You've
eaten gone a couple times, yes. Grab breakfast over there. Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of your, I think the best line in Marshall's piece was cheers without the beers.
Yes.
Because it had that sort of community aspect. People would go in, you know, everybody kind of knows each other, you feel like. And yeah, very much a kind of intimate, you know, kind of down home diner.
Been there about 40 years, almost 40 years, and it's still cash only.
That's right.
I'm excited about this series. I think there's going to be a lot of neat stories to come out of, but important stories too. We have some story ideas, but we'd like to hear more from the community. And
you can find Greg's email address on our website, wfae.org.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add about that?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm excited to see how it turns out as well.
Me
sure
too.
I'll contribute to it at some point.
You kind of gave the John's Country idea.
You want me to?
The John's Country Kitchen kind of came from you. You just
closing.
Came from breakfast.
I got breakfast there, and I found out that they were closing in 2 weeks because rent was going up, and this is a story that we'd certainly heard in Plaza Midwood before. It'll be interesting to see, you know, just sort of what happens in that neighborhood. It is a classic story. I think you heard it in Gwen's story about Cherry. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, there's very much both sides to gentrification. There always is.
And in fact, that when you brought that up, that kind of sparked the conversation for a series. So, thank you.
You're welcome.
One final note: we are saying goodbye today to our Croc intern. She's from NPR. She's on loan with us for 3 years, or three months. She's had a year long fellowship with NPR, and we've had her. We've been fortunate to have her with us since the early March.
Yeah,
and
she's been knocking it out of the park for the last 3 months. I don't know what we're going to do without her.
Yes.
Yeah. Lucy's been. Her name's Lucy Perkins.
Oh, yeah. She's been.
She's been doing a great job.
And I didn't say your name.
Has one more story coming up next week about the honeybee auditions.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, the honeybees are the cheerleaders for the Charlotte Hornets, right?
They are.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.